Eddie, are you done?
I'm done.
All right, I put you on the mic just because this is a new transition for the summer months. So we're trying to figure this out, right? Right?
Indeed.
All right, so
handing it over to the Moxer.
What kind of help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
What kind of help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
What kind of help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
What kind of help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
What help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
What help does the IRS have for identity theft victims?
If you suspect you're a victim of tax-related identity theft, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn how to prevent potential refund fraud and protect your tax account. At the IRS, combating tax-related identity theft is a top priority, and we are committed to prevention, detection, and assisting victims. And we're working with law enforcement to catch the criminals. For more info, go to irs.gov/identity theft to learn what the IRS is doing to help protect you.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, welcome to Ebony Spectrum and In Black America for another Wednesday.
University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America. NMSDC was created in 1972 as a direct result of President Nixon's executive order to address racial equity. It was came from the Black Civil Rights Movement. And it was a federal charter initially. So you had executive order created a Minority Business Development Agency under U.S. Department of Commerce to work with federal government on procurement, inclusion of minority-owned businesses. And so we were created in Chicago 51 years ago to facilitate the procurement opportunities for MBEs and Corporate America. So we became a partner with the Corporate America to build diverse, resilient supply chain. And so today we're kind of membership organizations. We supported about, we have about 780 national corporate members and hundreds of local corporate members, altogether about 1,700 corporate members. And so they provide funding, they provide opportunities, they provide mentoring.
Yang McGuire, President and CEO of the National Minority Supplier Development Council, Incorporated. In 2021, McGuire was named to a president position with the council. The Austin-based entrepreneur is the first non-African-American and first Asian CEO. Founded in 1972, the National Minority Supplier Development Council, Incorporated, is the longest operating business growth engine for the broadest group of systematically excluded communities of color, and the impact goes far beyond supply chain. The D.C.-based council is the most influential and successful minority business development organization in the country, and they are the gold standard in certification for minority-owned businesses who seek to do business with government or mainstream Fortune corporation who are members. I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, the National Minority Supplier Development Council, Incorporated, with President and CEO Yang McGuire, In Black America.
My platform was, hey, let's go global to mirror your corporate customers' global sourcing strategy. Interesting thing is, that is so important. I actually took a very active role in NMSDC's Global Link Initiative as a volunteer. And I helped NMSDC to incubate a supplier diversity organization in China. Now we have NMSDC Global Link had five affiliates. You know, we helped create those organizations in foreign countries that wish to emulate our practice to lift underprivileged communities through entrepreneurship, through supply diversity.
The mission of the National Minority Supplier Development Council is to serve as a growth engine for the NMSDC certified minority businesses, enable their members to advance economic equity. They create connections between minority business enterprises, MBEs, and corporations, MBEs in the public sector, and MBEs and other MBEs to help them benefit from each other, stroking entrepreneurship, and growing wealth from these systematically excluded communities. As president and CEO of the National Minority Supplier Development Council, Yang McGuire brings over two decades of leadership experience across both profit and nonprofit sectors. She held a leadership position with Dell Technology. There, she drove the strategy and execution of nearly quintupled Dell's diversity spending from $640 million to $3 billion within 3 years. In 2016, the United States Secretary of Commerce appointed her to the United States Investment Advisory Council. Recently, In Black America spoke with McGuire in studio.
How much time do we have? I have a long story. So I was born and raised in China during the Cultural Revolution. Mm. And then many people said it's one of the darkest periods in China. We had very modest living, drawing water from wells and, you know, cooked food from coal stoves. Didn't see a car until I was 17. Didn't ride a private car until 21. And my parents were teachers, so they were labeled as intellectuals during the Cultural Revolution. So they were sent to this called a re-education camp during the summer. So we were considered as a marginalized, underprivileged group because my parents were educated during the Cultural Revolution. And so it was very interesting. I bring very minimum material-wise we have, but what we did have was pursuit of education. And so I always, you know, my parents played very high value on education, very high value on work ethics and discipline. So I think that, to me, is like the best gifts I got from growing up. I didn't have anything, right? Mm-hmm. So, and what changed, what policy can make a huge difference on people's lives, I experienced in my early days. When the new leader, Deng Xiaoping, came to power, you probably read the history about, mm-hmm. you know, he had this famous saying says, I don't care if you're black cat or white cat, as long as you catch mice, you're a good cat. And he launched the market economy. And he basically said those who previously didn't have the privilege to go to college, now you can, as long as you're good students, you pass the entrance examination, which like lasted for 3 days straight, and you can go to college. And so that changed my life. I, you know, if was without Deng Xiaoping's market economy policy, I would have been sent to a remote village, work on the farm, you know. And so because of that policy change, I had the opportunity to compete, to go to college. And my parents says, you need to go to, we call it name brand college. It's equivalent to Ivy League school here. So my parents gave me go, you have to go to Ivy League school. So I did. And because the market economy, my parents, my family started textile manufacturing business. So like within matter of a few years, we went from under the poverty to great life. But I had a great education. You know, my family's doing well financially, eventually, but something was missing. And then that feeling became overwhelming in the wake of the Tiananmen Square incident. Mm-hmm. And when I packed up my life into one suitcase, $1,000, very little English, and moved here to pursue my American dream. People still today saying that I speak English.
So what year was that?
That was 1990.
Okay.
And so I had very little, but I had a promise in my heart, which was American dream. And when I was growing up, you know, people talk about America and they were teasing with me. They saying, if you dig hard enough, you go to America. So I did, actually. When I was young, I dig, right? But I actually flew and came to America. And so I imagined what later became a reality, higher education. So I received a MBA focused on international business with a Thunderbird School of Global Management in Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay.
And I had a great career and the respect in corporate America. I shared with you about my career with Dell Technologies. Like I graduated from Thunderbird. I had no experience and knew nothing about corporate America. And Dell Technology, our hometown corporation right here in Austin, Texas, gave me opportunity to perform. And so I did marketing, procurement, finance, operations. And the last few years, I was leading supply diversity. And I became a spokesperson of Dell in the small minority woman, veteran, disability business community. And that led me to become entrepreneur. So it's interesting life from corporate America, entrepreneurship, the rights to vote, and the privilege to serve as advisor to the government. So I had an opportunity to serve on the United States Investment Advisory Council for Secretary Pritzker. I had an opportunity to serve on the International Trade Center Advisory Board. And now I'm on the Council for Underserved Communities for SBA Administration. And then the other story is I have two amazing, beautiful children who are finally off my payroll. My son just...
So you think.
Yes. At least now. Yeah, for now.
So when you look back at your career thus far, how does your tenure at Dell assist you in doing what you currently do?
Oh, a great deal. One, it led me to supply diversity world.
Okay.
And so, two, the things I learned, I apply to today's work every day, the business skills, mm-hmm. you know. Running a nonprofit, it's just like running a business. The only difference is you're making impact, you're not making net profit. Okay. But everything else is the same. You're not bringing the best, brightest talent, investing technology, work on the branding, you know, drive cost up, the operational efficiency. All that I learned at Dell. And so that those skills, those knowledge, I use every day in what I'm doing today.
Now, the National Minority Supplier Development Council has been around for a while, this time.
Yes.
Give us a history of the council.
Sure. So NMSDC was created in 1972 as a direct result of President Nixon's executive order to address racial equity. It came from the Black Civil Rights Movement. And it was a federal charter initially. So you had executive order created a minority business development agency under U.S. Department of Commerce to work with federal government on procurement, mm-hmm. Inclusion of minority-owned businesses. And so we were created in Chicago 51 years ago to facilitate the procurement opportunities for MBEs and corporate America. So we became a partner with corporate America to build diverse, resilient supply chain. And so today we're kind of membership organizations. We have about 780 national corporate members and hundreds of local corporate members, all together about 1,700 corporate members. And so they provide funding, they provide opportunities, they provide mentoring opportunities with our MBEs and many things that we partner with them to really grow minority-owned businesses.
Now, how does an organization or a business join you all's organization, and why should they?
Yeah,
join?
So that's a great question, John. So we have two main stakeholders. One is corporate America.
Okay.
So the reason they want to join, number one, they're looking for qualified minority-owned businesses to be included in their supply chain. Okay. And so we're that place because we certify minority-owned businesses. We make sure they're minority-owned and controlled and managed, and therefore they're creating wealth in the community of the color, right? And we work with corporate America to develop them. If they're not ready today, we want them, help them to get there. Because like, corporate America's requirements are very rigorous, right? Mm-hmm. Doing business with Dell, for example, it's not an easy thing to do. And then we connect the corporate America with qualified, we call it MBEs, Minority Business Enterprises. And so they join. The other reason they join is we created those industry groups where they can share best practice with each other so they can do a better job to include minority businesses in their supply chain. The other thing is sometimes we help them create business cases so they can sell back to the corporate America why this is very important. So that's one set of stakeholders. Now the second set of stakeholders, minority business enterprises.
Okay.
And so we serve the certified with us, the MBEs. We call it NMSDC certified MBEs. And why they join us, it's really all about access. They have access to our network. From having access to our network, they have access to opportunities provided to us by Corporate America. They have access to knowledge, like we put together webinars, conference, and a forum, not only at the national level, but all by 23 affiliate councils. They do those programming all year round. And they have access to relationships. So I want to personally invite you to our conference, our annual conference actually happening in October 22nd to 25th. This year, it's in Baltimore. So we move conference to different communities to serve them. So in Baltimore, and there, you know, we connect them to opportunities. And also equally important is the capital. So we have a affiliate called a Business Consortium Fund. So they provide capital to smaller MBEs. And then we recently launched a capital manager program. We bring in large amount of capital, like equity, like, you know, debt and a mezzanine, all sorts of capital to MBE. So there are many benefits to be part of it. And we have seen these MBEs grow from under a million, the largest one's $19 billion. So we're the growth engine for NMSDC certified MBEs.
This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment. If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking of Yang McGuire, CEO and President of the National Minority Supplier Development Council. Ms. McGuire, how has the business world changed or adapted since the pandemic?
Changed quite a bit. You know, people get more nimble and flexible. And before pandemics, if you tell people that you can't hire remote workforce, they're like, hell no. You need to come to the office. You know, I remember I was working with a mid-sized minority-owned business company. My boss was like, you cannot wear a G, you have to come to office, right? And so because the pandemic, that the business have adapted, they're now hiring people from around the country. You have access to big pool. And also, I think businesses become more conscientious about sustainability. Because when pandemic happened, like Michael Dell said something in the Twitter, say, everybody's the same. Doesn't matter what title, how much money you have, we're all in the same boat. So I think people woke people up, people start to realize that we actually need to drive sustainable growth. We need to pay attention to the social impact, the environmental impact on all of that. There's many things has changed since pandemic happened. The other thing has changed, you have seen, that we realize that when this kind of natural disaster happened, the impact on underprivileged communities like Black community is greater. For example, the racial wealth gap has increased by 70% since the pandemic started, right? So our work is even more important to address these inequity.
Now, when you look at the global map, what are some of the untapped potentials that are out there for minority enterprises?
Huge. Because, you know, people are saying greater than 90% of consumers outside of U.S.
Okay.
And so if you're not going global, then you're missing a huge chunk of market potential. So when I was with Dell, I was leading the supply diversity initiative for Dell. My platform was about taking MBE, going global to mirror Dell's global sourcing strategy. Because when we buy hundreds of millions and billions and all over the world. And if AMBE only can serve one little geographical location, they may be phased out.
Gotcha.
Right? So my platform was, hey, let's go global to mirror your corporate customers' global sourcing strategy. Interesting thing is that is so important. I actually took a very active role in NMSDC's Global Link initiative as a volunteer. And I helped NMSDC to incubate a supplier diversity organization in China. Now we have NMSDC Global Link had five affiliates. You know, we helped create those organizations in foreign countries that wish to emulate our practice to lift underprivileged communities through entrepreneurship, through supply diversity. And earlier this year, I actually brought on a Austinite, Fang Fang, who previously was the CEO of the Greater Austin Asian Chamber of Commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And so she transitioned and joined us, and now she's leading the global program. We call it a Global Link program. Now she added three more partners to our program. So now we have India, Brazil, and Chile. And Fawn and I just took a trip to India. And we had some conversation with underprivileged minority community in India. And interesting things, they have a leader, and he actually was inspired by Martin Luther King. He was inspired by Booker Washington's Black Capitalism model. And so they have like a called a Dalit community. They're the bottom 25% of the society. Mm-hmm. So he is working to lifting his community through the entrepreneurship and supply diversity. And so we're partnering with him. And so the globalism is very important for our MBEs so they can expand their market potential. But it's also very important for us to help other countries that wish to lift their underserved communities through entrepreneurship and the supply diversity.
In a different interview that you had, you talked about transformation, technology, data, emerging markets, and economic dynamics. Talk to us about how the transformation of the business world is affecting what you do and what needs to happen for future entrepreneurs.
Oh, absolutely. So internally, you know, we're going through the transformation. You know, NMSDC created the first non-governmental third-party certification for businesses. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, MBE later on, you have a woman certification, veteran certification, mm-hmm. and they kind of learned from us. But that was created 50 years ago before we had a cell phone internet. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you have a technology-driven solution with AI. And so internally, we're transforming our organization and modernize our certification, which we created gold standard 50 years ago, but okay. we need to evolve and make our operations more efficient and consistent through technology. So we're going through the whole thing, and we had a corporate member did a pro bono study, and we have a whole technology roadmap we're materializing. But for our businesses, they need to pivot. Mm-hmm. And so they need to look at what are the industries of a future and make sure they are pivoting to the industries of a future. You know, if you are in, let's say you sold to automotive industries, you know, you made seats or you made truck bed and you made things for engines. And in the future, with electrification, you may not need the parts for engine anymore. Mm-hmm. Now you need to learn how to make batteries. You know, mm-hmm. now you need to learn how to mine cobalt and lithium and learn how to make a charging station, install them and service them. So, mm-hmm. so, and the clean energy space, the infrastructure spend, you know, all of those our MBEs really need to understand what are the industries of a future. In AI space, for example, there's mm-hmm. a lot of opportunities. So what we are doing, for example, at the conference, really bring in these industry leaders to talk about what are the opportunities mm-hmm. of a future and how MBEs and what they need to do to pivot to those industries of future so they're not left behind. So a lot of work that we're doing.
I also understand that you all have a African-American Farmers Initiative and the opportunities there. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, so what we do is we look at the data and we see issues and we try to solve issues. So the McKinsey and Company published the data saying, look, right now you have 1.4% of farmers are black farmers. Mm-hmm. Comparing to 14% a century ago. So we're really going a wrong direction. And so we said, what can we do about it? And luckily, fortunately, we have corporate members like Cargill, like Walmart. They're committed mm-hmm. to buy from black farmers, but they need qualified black farmers mm-hmm. to buy from. So we partnered. Again, it is a nonprofit and a corporate partnership. So we partnered and created a 12-week capacity building program. So like, you know, we'll start one cohort and graduate them, and we bring another cohort. We're starting the second cohort. Mm-hmm. So when they graduate, they should be in a much better position to do business with like Walmart and a Cargill. And so there are real economic impact when we do that kind of program.
Are there any particular cities around the nation that are ripe for African-American entrepreneurship?
I say every city should be ripe for the African-American businesses, right? And it require leaders like us to have to see this, to develop black businesses as economic development, not as a compliance. If people see this as economic development, every city should be good. But the one city came to my mind right now is Tulsa.
Really?
And I went to Tulsa, was invited by Rebuild Tulsa and the George Kaiser Foundation. Mm-hmm. It was early this year, maybe late last year. And I heard about the Tulsa race massacre, but I've never really seen like these photos, like mm-hmm. the people in the community talking about it. And then I realized one of my favorite person, black leader, who's on our steering committee, John Rogers, that mm-hmm. his, I think, grandfather had this thriving hotel chain and it was burned down mm-hmm. to ashes. And so they told me all these stories how Tulsa was the economic center for black community and because historic systemic racism like burned down. So that gave me inspiration. One day I want to go back to Tulsa to rebuild the Black Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And so to me, like, you know, that came back to my mind is it will be great to build economic center in Tulsa again for the black community.
At the end of the day, when do you realize you've had a good day?
That I made impact on a minority business. So when a business called me say, hey, I got another contract because I met someone at your conference, or they say I created a new product because your Center of Excellence program, that's a good day. One good day, I started to publish economic impact study because we need to measure economic impact, not just spend, right? How many jobs created and what is economic output and wages and all of that. It's all about job creation. And a good day was this past May, we had our second annual Minority Business Economic Forum. We created a year ago to really learn from the World Economic Forum. I call it Davos for minority-owned businesses. And there we published the data that we actually generated 20% year-over-year growth for NMSDC-certified MBE revenue. Now, that was a good day.
Ying McGuire, President and CEO of the National Minority Supplier Development Council, Incorporated. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and X. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
On the Black World Media Network, this is Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats. Here is the reviewer, Professor Todd Stephen Burroughs.
I'm Todd Stephen Burroughs. Oh my God, I've got so much back stuff to mention. I'm literally just going to take this commentary and mention some things. You can follow up on them, hopefully, at your local bookstore or wherever you buy your books. First of all, let's talk about Rita Dove. She's going to receive the National Book Foundation's Medal for Distinguished Contribution to American Letters. That is NBF's Lifetime Achievement Award. Dove's body of work includes 11 books of poetry, a collection of her poet laureate lectures, a short story collection, and a play. She is the winner of the 1987 Pulitzer Prize for Thomas and Bueller, her third collection of poetry. From 1993 to 1995, Dove served as the first Black Poet Laureate of the United States, and she is the only poet to date to have received both the National Humanities Medal and the National Medal of Arts. Poet Jericho Brown will present this award to Dove at the 73rd Annual National Book Awards on November 15th. On behalf of the Black World Media Network, congratulations to Rita Dove. I want to mention a graphic novel done by Ibram X. Kendi. Kendi is a very well-known scholar who has developed this kind of anti-racism curriculum that has really angered the right. And so he's done a lot of different things, main books, textbooks, books for children. And in this case, he has a graphic novel called Stamped from the Beginning. It is a graphic history of racist ideas in America. Kendi is continuing his anti-racism campaign, and he's continuing to use books. He also, by the way, has an online black newspaper, The Emancipator, that is done in cooperation with the Boston Globe. So if you're interested in more of these ideas, you can definitely check out The Emancipator. The book is called, again, Stamped from the Beginning, and this is one of many, many books that Kendi has. Now, this last month was Black August. And Black August is where elements of the Black activist community bring attention to Black political prisoners. I am the consultant to an exhibit at Brown University dealing with the papers of Mumia Abu-Jamal. But I wanted to point out a rally that Prison Radio is part of in Washington, D.C. That rally is on the birthday of a very well-known Native American political prisoner, Leonard Peltier. Leonard Peltier turned 79 on September 12th, and he has been under lock and key now for almost 50 years, according to Prison Radio's email that I have. And I wanted to bring up Leonard Peltier because I wanted to mention his book, My Life is My Sundance, has a lot of his writings there. And it's important, I think, to recognize these imprisoned authors, particularly the political prisoner authors. Now, let's move on to Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. The great African author has a children's book called Mama's Sleeping Scarf. It's a tender story about a little girl's love for her mother's scarf and the adventures she shares with it and her whole family. Chino loves the scarf that her mama ties around her hair at night. When mama leaves for the day, Chino takes it on endless adventures. Peeking through the colorful haze of the silky scarf, Chino Boy Bunny can look at her whole family as they go through their routines. So that's Mama's Sleeping Scarf from Sister Adichie. As we know, is a treasure of African letters and a daughter of Nigeria. Another book I want to point out, The Artivist. This is a children's book that encourages children to become artists and activists. So you know we like that here at the Black World Media Network. This book is written by Nicholas Smith, who defines himself as an artivist from Houston, Texas. And he's a Hollywood film illustrator. Art and activism has always gone hand in hand in the African-American community and in the African community. So let's support this book, The Artivist, and give it to our children to get them both in a political and a cultural mode. I want to point out there is a Q&A about Tina Turner. The article is called What's God Got to Do with It? PW talks with Ralph H. Craig III. And Craig, who's a lecturer of religion at Dartmouth, traces Tina Turner's spiritual path in his book called Dancing in My Dreams, which comes out in November. So look up What's God Got to Do with It? That's got to be a fascinating discussion, since Tina Turner was probably one of the most famous African-American Buddhists to ever exist. Now, one more book, Jelani's Key, another children's book. It's a new middle grade book, and it's published by the AALBC, our African-American book publisher for young readers. And here's the plot. Tata was now among the ancestors, but he left his grandson, Jelani, a golden key and a note bearing a cryptic riddle. Find Karakamun. Mourning his late grandfather and with little to go on, 11-year-old Jelani must set off to fulfill Tata's mysterious wishes. His quest will put him on a collision course with a legend and immerse him in a mind-bending overnight challenge that, if navigated successfully, will unveil his grandfather's true legacy and change Jelani's life forever. Again, that's the book Jelani's Key, by D. Amari Jackson. Okay, there's so much more I could talk about, but I think that is enough. Please go support your local Black bookstore, go support your independent bookstore, and buy online. There's a treasure trove to deal with. We're in a golden age, and we don't know it. So I'll declare it right now. We're in a golden age. I'm Todd Stephen Burrows.
That was Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats, presented by reviewer Professor Todd Stephen Burrows, journalist, historian, and popular culture enthusiast. On the Black World Media Network, this is Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats. Here is the reviewer, Professor Todd Stephen Burrows.
I'm Todd Stephen Burrows, and this is Book Bundle. We've been doing a special week on Gil Scott-Heron, and today is the third and last day of it, in which we're going to be reading excerpts from The Last Holiday, a memoir. That is Gil Scott-Heron's memoir, about him and Stevie Wonder doing a concert tour to try to push for a Martin Luther King holiday. He combines that with his life. So I wanted to start with an epigraph. And, you know, when you're Gil Scott-Heron, right, you know, you can write your own epigraph, right? You don't need to quote somebody else, right, when you're one of the greatest Black poets of the 20th century. So you write your own epigraph. So here's the epigraph. It's called, appropriately, Dr. King. I admit that I'd never had given it much thought as to how much of a battle would have to be fought to get most of Americans to agree and then say that there should actually be a Black holiday. But what a hell of a challenge. How far would Stevie go to make them pass legislation tabled 10 years in a row? I didn't doubt for a second that the brother was sincere, but how many minds had come together in the last 12 years? How many folks recognized that America had to grow? And who else could convince them that yesterday had to go? I'd like the idea of a minister being around when raising for high stakes to have his foot near the brakes because of what truly could have gone down. I thought America could have blown up before it could ever be said that we had grown up. And for whatever reason, were there Americans who never knew that Dr. King prevented chaos and would give him his due? I admired Stevie's enthusiasm and that he spoke his mind, but right does not triumph over wrong every time. Gandhi took nonviolence with him when he died. Over here, there was nonviolence, but only on one side. When white folks beat up and kill people that you knew, you might direct your anger at a building or two instead of making the Old Testament a civil rights guide and saying that an eye for an eye would now be justified. We were told to accept that some white folks had no class, and instead of condemning white people en masse, we were told remaining peaceful would be the best thing, and directing that philosophy were men like Dr. King. Through a storm of provocation to fight, we saw that in order to change America, you must change the law. They called us militants and radicals, and were made to look bad for trying to secure all rights Americans had. But behind what's often written is where you find the real thing. So America might not have made it without Dr. King.
That was Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats, presented by reviewer Professor Todd Stephen Burrows, journalist, historian, and popular culture enthusiast.
Christmas here at home. Christmas time back in the country. And I'm here just for one special day. And all the gifts have been given. Got my children on my knees. The biggest smile in Louisiana. Whoa, 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 looking up at me. It's Christmas time in the country. And soon I'll be gone. Thank God for being with him. To spend my Christmas back home. Oh, Merry Christmas, y'all.
The assassination of President John F. Kennedy is the greatest murder mystery in American history. I was 16 years old when it happened, and it has never left me.
That's Rob Reiner, creative powerhouse behind the films When Harry Met Sally, The Princess Bride, to name a few. Recently, Rob called me, Soledad O'Brien, and asked me what I knew about this crime, which happened 60 years ago. I know the government's first investigation concluded that a lone gunman named Lee Harvey Oswald killed the president. I also know that 15 years later, the government backtracked on that story and said the assassination was a result of a conspiracy. 60 years later, new leads are still emerging. To me, an award-winning journalist, that's the making of an incredible story. And on this podcast, you're going to hear it told by one of America's greatest storytellers. So, Rob, you're the one who's done the reporting on this story, so I'm going to let you lead me on this journey.
Okay. Well, to solve any murder, you start at the scene of the crime.
Kennedy apparently shot in head. He fell face down in back seat of his car.
The single bullet theory holds that one bullet entered the president's back, moved upward. Then, when the bullet comes out, it's moving again, downward, leftward, and forward. Turns in midair. How in the hell is that possible?
And we'll answer decades-long questions by talking directly to people who were there.
Mrs. Kennedy stood up, and right behind where she had been sitting, there was a pristine bullet.
Then we'll ask, who had the motive to assassinate a sitting president?
My dad, Bob JFK, screwed us at the Bay of Pigs, and then he screwed us after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Then we'll pull the curtain back on the cover-up.
I've said that the agency cooperated with us. I misspoke.
Were you mad?
Furious.
We'll reveal why Lee Harvey Oswald isn't who they said he was.
Well, I was under the impression that Lee was being trained for a specific operation.
We'll introduce you to people who attempted to reveal the truth, only to pay the ultimate price.
He was chopped up and stuffed in an oil drum and thrown into the Biscayne Bay.
Until eventually, we make our way back to Dallas on November 22nd, 1963.
I asked my mom, where's Papa? And she said, he's in Dallas on business.
I glanced over my shoulder and I saw a package on the back seat. And so I said, what's in the package, Lee?
Why does it matter? For those of us who were born after it happened, I think we miss that sense of like what America lost.
President Kennedy's death was a profound national trauma, the effects of which are still felt today. The American people need to know the truth.
When you and President Nixon conceived of the bombing of Cambodia, you did it in order to interdict.
Come on. We have been bombing with drones and all kinds of weapons every guerrilla unit that we were opposing. It's been the same in every administration of either party.
The consequences in Cambodia were particular.
Come on now.
This
is a program you're doing because I'm going to be 100 years old.
Right.
And you're picking a topic of something that happened 60 years ago. You have to know that it was a necessary step. Now the younger generation feels that if they can raise their emotions, they don't have to think. If they think, they won't ask that question.
On March 18, 1969, during the Vietnam War, the U.S. secretly began what would become a long and relentless bombing campaign in neighboring Cambodia. Had there been an international criminal tribunal for Cambodia, prosecutors would have had a field day with U.S. President Richard Nixon and his national security advisor and later Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. Establishing genocidal intent with these two would be a cakewalk. On December 9, 1970, Nixon would phone Kissinger to discuss the ongoing bombing of Cambodia. You see, Operation Menu, as it was called, was only an escalation of the bombing. Up to this point, close to 500,000 tons of bombs had already been dropped on Cambodia. 5 minutes after getting off of the call, Kissinger called General Alexander Haig to relay the new orders from the president. He wants a massive bombing campaign in Cambodia. He doesn't want to hear anything. It's an order. It's to be done. Anything that flies on anything that moves. You got that? On December 29th, 2023, Henry Alfred Kissinger died in his home in Kent, Connecticut, at the age of 100. His death has been met with an outpouring of sympathy and affection from major American news outlets, which may be even more troubling than his legacy. The Washington Post, along with a lengthy obituary, published a short piece on his, quote, carpet bombing of Cambodia. In it, the authors write, Ben Kiernan, a historian at Yale University and a leading scholar of the U.S. legacy in Cambodia, has estimated that around 500,000 tons of U.S. bombs were dropped on Cambodia. Interestingly enough, this figure is from a paper that Kiernan wrote in 1989 called The American Bombardment of Kampuchea, where he cites a figure of 540,000 tons. However, either unbeknownst to the editorial staff at the Washington Post, or insidiously omitted, Ben Kiernan actually wrote another, lesser-known article published in the Canadian Walrus magazine, in collaboration with Owen Taylor at the University of Oxford. This article was reporting that in 2000, upon a state visit to Vietnam, President Bill Clinton announced that he would release extensive Air Force data on all American bombings during the Vietnam War from the years 1964 to 1975. The still incomplete database reveals that from October 4, 1965 to August 15, 1973, the United States dropped far more ordnance on Cambodia than was previously believed. 2,756,941 tons worth. To put 2,756,941 tons into perspective, the Allies dropped just over 2 million tons of bombs during all of World War II. Cambodia may be the most heavily bombed country in history. Moreover, the two announced, the data released by Clinton shows the total payload dropped during these years to be nearly five times greater than the generally accepted figure. Nick Terse, author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, has clearly been prepared to write Kissinger's obit for years. Terse can appropriately be called America's leading expert, if not a foremost expert worldwide, on American war crimes during the Vietnam War. His book is probably the only one of its kind, solely dedicated to chronologizing these crimes in detail. Kissinger helped to prolong the Vietnam War and expand the conflict into neutral Cambodia, facilitated genocides in Cambodia, East Timor, and Bangladesh, accelerated civil wars in Southern Africa, and supported coups and death squads throughout Latin America. He had the blood of at least 3 million people on his hands, according to his biographer Greg Grandin. He quotes Reed Brody, who worked on the Pinochet case in the UK. "Few people have had a hand in as much death and destruction, as much human suffering in so many places around the world as Henry Kissinger." Kissinger was born in Germany, born in the Bavarian town of Fürth in 1923. He was actually born Heinz. At 15, his family escaped the Holocaust, although at least 13 of their relatives would perish in concentration camps. In the U.S., he became Henry. Henry was withdrawn and bookish. In 1943, he was drafted into the army and went on to lead raids in Gestapo houses, earning himself a Bronze Star. He attended Harvard University, where he wrote a lengthy doctoral dissertation called A World Restored, about European diplomacy following the fall of Napoleon. From Harvard, he was placed in an elite study group at the Council on Foreign Relations, studying nuclear policy. His work, Nuclear Weapons and Foreign Policy, gave him cachet at Harvard and in foreign policy circles. He naturally became a consultant to the Kennedy and later the Johnson administrations. In 1968, he was offered a job in the Nixon administration. To his admirers, he was the brilliant architect of Pax Americana, the chess grandmaster. To his detractors, and even some friends and former employees, he was vain, conspiratorial, arrogant, and short-tempered. A man capable of praising a top aide as indispensable while ordering the FBI to illegally tap his home phones to see if he was leaking to the press. He was lauded for foreign policy successes. As the impresario of Nixon's historic opening to China, and as the theoretician of détente with the Soviet Union, Dr. Kissinger earned much of the credit for seismic policy shifts that redirected the course of world affairs. With his German accent, incisive wit, owlish looks, and zest for socializing in Hollywood and dating movie stars, he was instantly recognized all over the world, in stark contrast to most of his understated predecessors. Foreign policy expert Alfred W. McCoy of the University of Wisconsin-Madison has long been unimpressed by his record, writing in 2017, "Henry Kissinger was as inept as he was ruthless. Extending the Vietnam War by 7 bloody years to mask his diplomatic failure, turning East Timor over to Indonesia for decades of slaughter until its inevitable independence, cratering U.S. credibility in Latin America by backing a murderous military dictatorship in Chile, and mismanaging Moscow in ways that helped extend the Cold War by 15 years, Kissinger's career, as international law specialist Richard Falk observed, has been marked by his extraordinary capacity to be repeatedly wrong about almost every major foreign policy decision made by the U.S. government over the course of the last half century." It appears Kissinger's record in Bangladesh was too grave for the New York Times to ignore, as the Washington Post did. Perhaps the most egregious episode came in the signals to Pakistan that it was free to deal with Bengalis in East Pakistan as it saw fit. Indeed, when Pakistan's U.S.-backed military was waging a genocidal war in East Pakistan, now Bangladesh, in 1971, he and Nixon not only ignored pleas from the American consulate in East Pakistan to stop the massacre, but they approved weapon shipments to Pakistan, including the apparent illegal transfer of 10 fighter bombers from Jordan. The human cost was horrific. At least 300,000 people were killed in East Pakistan, and 10 million refugees were driven into India. They also add East Timor to his list of dastardly deeds, a country the Washington Post did not even name a single time. He and President Ford approved Indonesia's invasion of East Timor in December 1975. leading to a disastrous 24-year occupation by a U.S.-backed military. Declassified documents released in 2001 by the National Security Archive indicate that Ford and Mr. Kissinger knew of the invasion plans months in advance and were aware that the use of American arms would violate U.S. law. "I know what the law is," he said. They reported that more than 100,000 East Timorese were killed or starved to death. What they don't say is that that is a conservative estimate, and the number could be as high as 180,000, or up to a quarter of the entire population. They also don't mention that, according to the UN's Truth Commission set up after the Indonesian withdrawal, that mass starvation was used as a weapon of war. Of course, one has to mention the notorious Operation Condor, unmentioned by the New York Times or the Washington Post, but like I said, Nick Turse was prepared. "You did a great service to the West in overthrowing Allende," Kissinger later told General Augusto Pinochet, the leader of the military junta that went on to kill thousands of Chileans. In Argentina, Kissinger gave another green light, this time to a terror campaign of torture, forced disappearances, and murder by a military junta that overthrew President Isabel Perón. During a June 1976 meeting, Kissinger told the junta's foreign minister, "If there are things that have to be done, you should do them quickly." The so-called dirty war that followed would claim the lives of an estimated 30,000 Argentine civilians. Turse reminds us that Kissinger stoked a war in Angola and prolonged apartheid in South Africa. In the Middle East, he sold out the Kurds in Iraq. After Washington, Kissinger became wealthy through founding a consulting firm, Kissinger Associates. Turse writes, "The firm leveraged Kissinger's reputation and contacts to help huge multinational corporations, banks, and financial institutions, including American Express, Anheuser-Busch, Coca-Cola, Heinz, Fiat, Volvo, Ericsson, and Daewoo, broker deals with governments." The New York Times put it like so. When Disney sought to navigate the Chinese leadership to build a $5.5 billion park in Shanghai, Mr. Kissinger got the call. Kissinger also continued to write policy recommendations and articles and advised every single president from Nixon onwards. Indeed, current Secretary of State Anthony Blinken said upon Kissinger's death that he had sought counsel from the former diplomatic chief many times, including most recently about a month ago. Those who may be dismayed at how long Kissinger was able to live may have some solace in the fact that a mind that could unleash such hideous man-made horrors onto untold millions of people throughout the world and do so without hesitation or apology will never speak or advise another sitting U.S. official for the rest of time. And we can all breathe a deep sigh of relief for that.
I just had another dizzy spell and almost fell. I'm scared they will get worse and never go away.
You're not alone. 69 million people suffer from dizziness and vertigo.
I wonder if there's help.
There is. The Vestibular Disorders Association has a helpline at 800-837-8428 or visit liferebalanced.org.
Can you repeat that?
800-837-8428 or liferebalanced.org.
Sponsored by the Vestibular Disorders Association.
Thank you.